a very clear majority of all Eastern European Jews, whether your grandfather, great-grandfather, anyone's father from Poland or Eastern Europe? No? Okay. Whether your grandfather, great-grandfather, or great-great-grandfather was from somewhere in Eastern Europe, that it all has very much to relate to what's called Polish Jewry. Because before the great partitions of Poland and starting in 1772, it was all called Poland. And I mean, Jews who came over, I don't know anyone, Jews who came to America before 1920, Jews who came to the United States before 1920, like my grandparents, tended to say they were from Russia, even though they certainly didn't speak a word of Russian. Did not have a Russian accent. Because Russia ruled the vast majority of Poland, as we should know. Okay. Almost all of these Jews originated from Ashkenaz, from Germany. Almost all of them. And I'm not going to get into, if I get there in my regular 610 history now, I'll speak about the debate a little bit. There is some academic debate, questioning, etc. about it. But in this year like this, we're just I'm doing a quick helicopter tour. The facts are, as you may be aware, that all Jews from Eastern Europe spoke Yiddish, which in Yiddish is properly pronounced Yiddish. That's not Yiddish is an Americanization of it. Contrary to common belief, it's just common belief. German Jews and intellectuals looked down on Yiddish, calling it jargon. In other words, not a real language, and that has been substantially disproven. The modern linguists study Yiddish because Yiddish is more or less Middle German. In other words, German today spoken in Germany is High German, Hochdeutsch. German spoken by the Jews who got to Poland, as we're going to see here in the 1500s, retained Old German or Middle German. Not Old German, but Middle German. So it is no question, it is a proper language, and it is, studied. It's studied by linguists as we speak, probably. Okay. When did Jews get to Poland? The first charter that Jews had in Poland was in the year 1264. What does a charter mean? Jews before modern era, before the first country the Jews were legal citizens of was England. Jews, even though Jews were allowed into England by Oliver Cromwell in the 1650s or so, Jews were not legal citizens of England until 1740. So what did Jews do? I mean, Jews were living in most European countries before that. So what were they doing there? Say again?
Moneylenders.
We'll get to that in a little bit. What were they? I'm not asking what they were doing there to make money. I'm asking what was their legal status. So the answer is they were invited in. Just what they were invited in by the king, and given a charter of rights. They were special guests of the king, but not legal citizens of the country, which meant that they didn't have to do military duty, etc., etc., etc. On the other hand, that gave the king a power over them, which is why in the medieval era kings were able to expel the Jews without any problems. Now, again, the first charter known is from 1264. There certainly was not significant Jewish settlement in Poland until the 1300s, and even then it was small. We'll get to numbers a little later on, and we have a real number when we mention it. What was going on in the 1300s, broadly speaking, in Germany, where again most of the Jews came from, was the Black Plague in 1348. Various anti-Jewish riots, which I'm not even going to mention all of them right now, because again, it's like There was a lot of turmoil, unrest, anti-Semitic agitation against Jews in Germany. And as a result, Jews started moving east, Hungary, Bohemia. Bohemia is present-day Czech Republic. And Poland. Now, Bohemia / Czech Republic, and specifically Prague, has, you know, Rabbanim, has rabbis mentioned as early as the 1100s. So there was a substantial, there definitely was a clear established Jewish community in Prague from the 1100s. 2 years ago, when we went to Poland, we went to Prague. 2 years ago, we went to Prague, we dived in the Altneuschul. The Altneuschul is from the late 1200s. That was a really moving experience, for the record. Everything I did when I went 2 years ago, that was one of the most moving experiences I had, believe it or not.
Is that a good story?
The Altneuschul, part of it is still original, yes.
Is that where
the Golem of Prague is supposedly laid to rest? Yes. If you want to read up about it, I have an article I wrote 2 years ago about it, and I'm happy for you to look at it. I might even have it on the computer here, but I'm not sure if I do. I'll get my memory piece. I lent it to someone else for something, whatever. I'll get it back next week, and you can read. I have a whole write-up about it. Okay. So one assumes, at least my assumption is, because the first major Rabbanim mentioned in Poland are going to be the late 1400s and early 1500s. One assumes that they imported their rabbis from Germany and or Bohemia / the Czechs were really the serfs, and the Bohemia is really the German word, and the Germans were the aristocrats. So one assumes that's where they're importing their rabbis from, even though I'm not able to really substantiate that. This is my theory. Okay, now what else happened in the 1400s is Jews are progressively expelled from more and more places in Germany. Throughout the 1400s, Jews are progressively expelled from many places in Germany. And they couldn't go move into France because they had already been expelled from France. There's a limited amount of people who can move into Italy. The Netherlands / the Lowlands, which means Holland and Belgium, were ruled by the Spanish, and the Jews were ruled by the Burgundians. This is before the Spanish. The Jews really weren't that welcome there. The Jewish community in Holland starts in the 1500s. So where do you go? So they were moving east. Jews were moving east into, again, slowly more and more Jews moving into Poland. Now, there's a major, this will get to Yeshua's point, there's a major difference between Jewish involvement in Poland and what happened earlier in France and Germany. In France and Germany, as Shua mentioned, the Jews were primarily involved in usury and lending and banking. Rabbi Tam specifically was a very big banker. And the reason being is that the Catholic Church at that point in time did not allow Christians to lend other Christians money with interest. That was usur. In other words, it says it in the Torah, and they felt that applied at this point in time to, you know, Christian-to-Christian usury. So they were initially allowed to borrow from Jews, but, you know, let me tell you something. If you lend someone money, you're only going to lend them a significant amount of money if you know you can get the money back. You know, someone comes to you and says, can I have 5 shekel, 10 shekel, 50, 20 shekel, 50, I don't know, 50 shekel, you probably think about it. 100 shekel, I don't know, if the guy doesn't have, if he's not someone you really know, you're not going to lend a stranger 100 shekel, $100. If someone asks, can I borrow $10,000? So how am I going to get the money back? Who are you exactly? So the issue was government backing. That was the issue. Initially, the French government backed the Jewish loans. In Germany, the government never, there was really no centralized government in Germany, basically, And there was not government backing to Jewish loans in Germany, which meant Jews in Germany couldn't make that much money, and they were doing a lot of pawnbroking and low-level banking, low-level lending, not like real banking. But in France, until around, I believe the dates were around 1220, but I'd have to look back in my notes from the, you know, the regular history class, they had full government backing, and they were involved in big league banking. Now, in Poland, I mean, Jews are still doing some banking, but unlike France and Germany, where that was basically the only, you know, the only thing Jews were allowed to do, in Poland, Poland was a backward country, and they needed the Jews to economically develop the country. So Jews were welcome in the country with open hands, and we, you know, they needed also whatever profession is out there at this time was needed. And unlike in France and Germany, even when the Jews were allowed in France and Germany, Jews, if they were allowed to be, locksmiths, shoemakers, etc., they were limited. It was definitely not allowed to compete at large. I mean, the facts are there was a guild system in every European city and country, which limited the amount of people who could be shoemakers, tailors, etc., etc. And certainly Jews were very on the outside of that and not allowed to join in. I mean, one would assume Jewish commerce was, they were allowed to do, but that I'm not sure about either. I didn't see anyone ever say anything about. But in Poland's a backward country, and they were happy to have the Jews. So Jews start going to Poland, as it could be said. And there's a very famous pun that the Rabbanim said at this time, which is Poland, the word Poland in English is Poland in Yiddish. And you can make the following pun, which is Po Lin, which means here we rest. Po is here, Lin. Lin is resting in Tanakhic Hebrew. Can you tell us where that is? No, I shouldn't put you on the spot, should I? Yesh lanu makam lalun. Yesh lanu makam lalun. Does anyone recognize the pasuk?
No.
Say again? Eliezer asks Rivka, do you have a place for me to sleep? Okay, fine. So the word lun, lin, lina is Tanakhic and Mishnaic Hebrew for resting. And Poland was considered a very nice, peaceful place for Jews to move, and a lot of Jews moved there. Now, Polish historians say that initially, back in the old days, in other words, from like 1300 to, let's say, probably as late as maybe even as late as 1800, but certainly as late as the mid-1600s, Poles were not that religious Catholics. In other words, they were Catholics, they were Christians, many of them were Catholics. The Reformation of Poland is beyond the scope of this year and the one I'm giving in the other books. I don't think I'm going to get it. I'm not just going to have time to do proper work on it, but whatever. They were not that religiously devoted Christians. And there's no question there is a certain correlation between anti-Semitism and how devoted of a Christian a person is. There is definitely a correlation. I'm not sure the depth of that correlation, but there definitely is some connection. The fact that the Poles themselves had only converted to Christianity in, let's say, the middle 1100s, their recent converts to Christianity, and they're for the records, anyone who knows anything about idol worship, which is really Avodah Zarah, the Poles had a very primitive system. They're not really developed of the Avodah Zarah, either for the records. And either way, they were not really that devoted. They were not that devoted to Christianity initially. And it's also probable that that's also one of the factors, we're going to get into another factor in a moment, of why they weren't really, why there was less anti-Semitism in, you know, late medieval, early modern Poland. Okay. Now, one of the most key, it's a shame I don't have a good map here, but okay, one of the most key important events in Polish and Jewish, in Polish-Jewish history. In 1386, the original Polish dynasty dies out, and there's one heiress, one young lady, a 12-year-old queen, you know, princess, who obviously can't rule Poland. But whoever marries her will rule Poland. And the Polish nobility were looking around to figure out who should marry her. So what they did was, They said she should marry. Yeah, well, in English he's called Jagiellon, but in Polish he's called Jagiellon. He was the Grand Duke of Lithuania. Now, today, if you look on a modern contemporary European map, you'll see that Lithuania is a very small country. A very small country. It's so small, as a matter of fact, there was an old European joke which goes like this. The symbol of Lithuania was a horse standing on its hind legs. Yeah, so the Jewish European joke about it is, why is the symbol of Lithuania a horse standing on its back legs? Because if he puts his front legs down, he'll be out of Lithuania. If you look on a map, you'll understand the joke. If you don't know European geography, you don't get the joke. So remember the joke and go look at a map if you don't know the geography, and then say, wow. Okay, but the thing is like this. It's originally, the Lithuanians were the last pagan nation in Europe. They converted in 1386 when Jagiellon married Hedwiga, princess of Poland. That is when they converted. And Lithuania ruled a much larger swath of territory than Poland. Much, much larger. In other words, most of eastern Poland, Belarus, pronounced, that's how Russians pronounce it actually. Most of the Ukraine was all ruled by Lithuanians. Now these places back in those days, today they're like big countries, but back in those days there was a large amount of country, a large amount of territory, but it was sparsely inhabited. So again, you know, a large amount, like half of the Polish-Lithuanian aristocracy were even more recent converts to Christianity. And according to Polish historians, they still honored the pagan sites in like devious fashions. Instead of being, you know, I don't remember their names, but instead of being the shrine to whatever this deity was, they called it the shrine of Saint, same exact name. Okay, so the Lithuanian aristocracy was even less, you know, the Christianity was less rooted amongst them, and they were the ones primarily who ended up hiring Jews to manage their estates in the Ukraine. The Jagiellon dynasty ruled Poland from 1386 until 1572. Now, Poland at this point in time is at the height of its, you know, I don't know, call it domination, because domination means that you have real opponents. And the facts are, historically speaking, they weren't really that successful against the Teutonic Knights. Russia was not really an organized country. Hungary was also not much more, it was only slightly more civilized than Poland. So to call it a period of, you know, Polish domination, I think is an inaccuracy. They expanded. There was a lot of, you know, like, there's no real competition. They were better organized than anyone else. But and as a result of that, they were able to expand and found, and that's like, by Polish historians, this is considered the golden era of Poland. But okay, I don't know. It's not that in the later part of this time, you know, Martin Luther put his famous, I don't remember how many resolutions or whatever they're called, 95, whatever it is. Not that, what? Edicts? Theses. Oh wow, I'm impressed. So many guys know that. Wow. Okay, he tacked them up on the church and wherever it was. And that starts the Reformation in 1521 approximately. And Germany is absolutely seized by turmoil, religious turmoil and conflict for a solid 130 years. Absolutely, no question about it. And Germany wasn't really united beforehand because it was called the Holy Roman Empire, the German nation. So on the western side they didn't have any pressure, on the eastern side they didn't have any real pressure. So, because there's no real competition, they were doing pretty good. But in 1500, it's estimated there were around 30,000 Jews in Poland. I've said this in my regular history class, but you have to understand that pre-modern world, pre-1800, all statistics are unclear. Historians love to debate about them, and I'm not saying that in terms of historical analysis, one shouldn't worry at all about numbers pre-1800. I'm not being like radical, but you have to realize that numbers pre-1800 are all questionable. They're largely going to be based on tax records, and as you know, you could prove it. You know, Polish historians like to throw out anti-Semitic remarks about the Jews, about the tax records and how many Jews were paying taxes, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. One could show from Spanish non-Jewish records that the Spanish weren't that more interested in paying taxes than the Jews. I mean, the facts are is no one likes to take their money out and give it to someone else, right? That's just the fact. Okay, dinu d'machlus d'dinu, sugis of shas, we're not getting into that. But we're just getting, in terms of history and trying to bring, population proof from tax records, it's not that it's nothing, but it's obvious that it's an approximation. So the approximation is around 30,000 Jews in Poland in 1500, which is significant, but it's definitely, this is right after the expulsion of Jews from Spain, 1492, expulsion of Jews from Spain. It's not the largest Jewish community in any one country in the world, but it is significant. Okay, Rabbi Yaakov Polak, and the word Polak means someone from Poland. And that's sort of like Polak, but in Yiddish you pronounce it Polak. Polak. So it's basically the same thing, more or less. He died around 1530. He founded the first yeshiva in Poland. He founded the first yeshiva in Poland in Lublin. As a basic theme in Jewish history is if you don't have yeshivas, then the community doesn't really do much. So Rabbi Yaakov Polak and having the first real yeshiva, first real higher Torah education in Poland is definitely a landmark, an important date in Polish Jewish history in terms of, real development. Okay, he was succeeded by Rabbi Shalom Shachna. He succeeded Rabbi Shalom Shachna, who died in 1558. Both of these people were known for what's known as Pilpul. No one knows. The problem with Pilpul is that no one wrote it down. Pilpul is, the only people who spoke about Pilpul were people who were against Pilpul. Pilpul means literally hot peppers. But it means theoretical debate of no practical use. The opponents of Pilpul wrote about it, didn't write any of the Pilpul down, so it's no one's sure. I've never seen anyone clearly describe what Pilpul is. But both of these, both Rabbi Yaakov Polak and Rabbi Shalom Shachna did, utilize what's the methodology of Pilpul in their yeshiva in Lublin. And they're known, Rabbi Shalom Shachna specifically is known for not his halachic works, because he did not author any halachic works, but rather his students, of which the most famous is the Ramah, Ramosha Isserles. The Ramah lived from 1530 to 1572, and he was not merely a student of Shalom Shachna, he also married his daughter. This is Rav Shalom Shachna's son-in-law. A good friend of mine says, see, we're projecting here. Let me just show you how you write. It doesn't work. Do any better? This is the Lamed, if you can't tell. Okay, that's how you write Ramosha Isserles. Now we pronounce it Ramosha Isserles as if there's a yud here. A friend of mine, and this is I think he's right, but I can't prove it absolutely. It's probably Ramosha Isserles' father's name was Yisrael. Now, Isser, like Izzy. You know, anyone know Izzy? Okay. If you know anyone, whose name is Yisrael, and it can have an English nickname, Izzy. Right? Okay. So, Isser is a Yiddish nickname for Yisrael. And it is probably correctly not Ramosha Isserles, Ramosha Isserles. In other words, Jews didn't have formal last names. Ashkenazi Jews only started adopting formal last names in the 1760s. So it's inaccurate to think his last name was Isserles. They were called like, you know, Ramosha ben Yisrael. So another way to say it is Ramosha Isserles, because that's how you say son of Isser in Yiddish. Okay. Anyway, Ramosha Isserles was a very, he must have been very quite brilliant, because he became rabbi of Krakow in 1550, which meant he was about 20 years old. Now, his mother, then his wife, then his grandmother, all died about a year and a half after he became rabbi in Krakow. And as a result, he founded a shul in Krakow, which is known as the famous Ramosh Shul in Krakow. What the Ramosh is most famous for, of course, is his commentary, his additions, his emendations, as they're properly called, to Shulchan Aruch. Shulchan Aruch was written by Rabbi Yosef Karo to be machria, to show how we should, you know, what we should do in terms of Jewish law. Just let me finish this, and then don't forget your question. The Beis Yosef, Rabbi Yosef Karo, paskins the Rambam, Rif, and Rosh, 2 out of 3, which means he usually paskins like the Rambam, but not always. And of course, it's a little more complicated. That's like slightly oversimplifying things. You know, as we say, every rule has its exceptions, except for this one. Okay. So the Ramah added in the Ashkenazi custom of psak, which is based on the Trumas Hadeshen, the Mahariel, as I spoke about in the regular history class, and that is like very key, because the absolute foundation of Jewish law is Shulchan Aruch with the Ramah. Yeah.
I don't know when
Rabbi Yosef Karo lived. He was born in 1488. And he died in 1570 something. Yeah.
If the Rabbi Sakhar did like such a big job, like all the 3 days before they came and they didn't have a vote, how did the Ramah, like, how was he able to come and like take the first photos like the Ashkenazi Jew and kind of like include it?
Okay, that's a good question, more complicated. I've discussed it some in my regular 610. I'll probably get back to it more a little later. And as I say, generally speaking, in a shiur like that, if you want, you can sit down to me tonight at dinner tonight, and I'll try to explain it to you as best as I can. Okay, Vajra. Whatever you want. Okay, another big name at this time, at this period of Polish Jewish history, is the Maharshal. The Maharshal. Shlomo Luria. How's that for unclear handwriting? 1510 to 1573. What? Moreno Harav. Okay. The Maharshal was born in Poland. Originally rabbi in Brisk, and later on, at the end of his life, a number of other communities, at the end of his life in Lublin. The Maharshal is like sort of what I call a balancing act, because see, halacha is very complicated, and if you want, I'll try to explain it to you more or less over dinner, but it's complicated. It's not, you know, it's not, it's complicated. And the Maharshal is very, very important, very sharp and important Posek, and I'm not, you know, I don't think I'm going on this trip, but if I am, I'll speak about it when. Okay, now, in Jewish world at large, we have a very important development happening all around this time, which is the Ari, the Arizal, and Kabbalah. Now, the Kabbalah really was there for the entire time. The dissemination of the Zohar started in the late 1200s. I spoke about that already. Other places, that means a couple of weeks ago. However, the Ari is very, very important. I don't really know that much about Kabbalah, to be honest. Can I also tell you that most people who think they know a lot about Kabbalah know less than me about Kabbalah? Because they don't know anything. The Vilna Gaon, who knew a lot about Kabbalah, says there's no question, says there's a simple statement that there is an absolute direct correlation between Nigla and Nistar, between revealed Torah and hidden Torah. And the hidden Torah and the Nigla and the mystical secrets are merely the depth, not merely, they are the true depth of Nigla, of the revealed Torah. So a friend of mine who has studied Kabbalah seriously told me that the difference between Kabbalah pre-Ari and post-Ari is like just shocking. It's such a stark, major, quantifiable difference. It's like practically between. I don't remember if he told me it's more of a difference, even greater than between Mishnah and Gemara. I don't remember if he used that radical of a statement, but it's a major, major issue. In other words, I believe the statement he told me is like pre-Ari, you don't really see sugyas, and post-Ari, you see clear sugyas and clear ideas developed amongst, throughout the Zohar, etc., etc. Anyway, the Ari lived as we know. He was born in Yerushalayim. He lived most of his life in Egypt, and he died in 15. I don't know if I wrote it down. I think 1572 is the right date, but it might be 1574. Then we have the right date on me here. As you should know, he moved to Tzfat and had two Talmidim in Tzfat, Rabbi Yisrael Saruk, or Sarug, and Rabbi Chaim Vital. Those were his two big Talmidim. There are two major issues with Kabbalah, which again, I'm not going to speak about here, but I will speak about in my regular extent. And that is Kabbalah and Halacha. It's a big issue. In other words, when the Kabbalah seems to go, when it seems to go against the Halacha, or tell you to do things the Halacha doesn't say anything about, what do we do with it? That's one issue. And the other issue is dissemination. Who do you teach it to? That was a major question. Reb Chaim Vital was of the opinion that it should only be taught to the select few, and should not be taught on a mass level. Others disagreed, and I saw this in what a basically accurate source, but didn't really research it in an accurate source. Reb Chaim Vital actually buried his notes before he died. In other words, all his notes from the Ari, he buried. And then later his son came, as I saw this again in a basically accurate source, but I'm not sure if it's like really accurate. So his son came, let's say 30 years after he died or 20 years after he died, and dug his notes up and then printed them. So yeah, I don't know. I have to research that one and see if that was really true or that's just folklore, because you never know. What's happening in Israel? There was a viable community. The Turks were ruling, and I just don't. The Turks were ruling Israel. And again, if you're really interested, then in 2 and 3 weeks from now, I'll be doing it in the regular. That's exactly where I'm holding in the regular history class. Okay. Now, the Kisvei Ari and Talmidei Ari were slowly moving through Europe after the Ari's death. And it was a major, major, revolution, not a revolution, but major change, addition to what was going on. And we'll get back to that in not that long. Okay, what's going on in Poland? Poland, instead of founding a new dynasty after the last Jagiellon dies, 1572, they come up with a great idea. They're going to have an elective monarchy. Now, I know we think an elective monarchy is like totally insane, and just having an elective monarchy is not really, that was not the Polish problem, per se, because Germany had an elective monarchy, but it wasn't, the problems Germany had were not due to them having an elective monarchy. The problem was, is there was a dual way that the Polish elective monarchy worked. One way was any member of the nobility was allowed to vote. That means there were theoretically 50,000 people approximately allowed to vote in the election. Now that's not the problem. The problem is there was a famous Polish rule called single man veto. If one person said no, then the man's not elected. Now, no, of the nobility, of the Schlachta. What? Of those 50,000 people, if one person says no, story's over. How did they ever elect anybody? A lot of bribery. Now, okay, there were a couple of points in time when the Poles got together and elected a good candidate. As a matter of fact, the first candidate who they elected, Stephen Batory, was actually a good one, considered by Polish historians one of the greatest kings of Poland. But it was not, you know, I've read a number of Polish history books, and I'll tell you there's three things Poles are very sensitive about. Three things they're very sensitive about. One is saying, slights to their intelligence. The second one is accusations of anti-Semitism. After you go there, you'll know what I mean. And the third one is accusation of, lack of martial bravery, lack of, military bravery. And there's no question that the Poles are militarily brave. That we're not going to question. That we'll give them. They're definitely militarily brave. I mean, look, who else would send cavalry or tanks? I don't know if they really did that, but they did. But they were very, they did some very brave things, which didn't make that much sense historically speaking. Okay, so now happening all about the same time is in 1581. In 1581, the Poles gave the Jews practically full autonomy, which means self-rule. It's something very famously known as the Wad Shalosh Arba Chamesh, the Council of the Three, Four, or Five Lands, depending what year we're talking about. Three, five, and four lands, really. First it was three, then it was four, then it was five, then it was four. So there's the Wad, it's really called historically Wad Arba Arutzos, because most of the time it was four lands. And the Jews had practically full autonomy from 1581 until 1764. Now, in 1575, historians estimate the population of Jews in Poland as and no less than 100,000 and probably closer to 150,000. And that means at this point, there is no question, by 1575, Jewish community in Poland was the largest in the world, and it just got larger and larger as things go on.
This is because
the reason why is it growing in the 1500s is because the Reformation was accompanied by even more expulsions from Germany, and by 1550, the only places Jews were allowed to live in Germany were ecclesiastic states, which means church states. So you're expelled from Germany. Poland may be backwards, but there's a lot of economic opportunity there. I mean, where else? What are you going to do? So a lot of Jews moved to Poland. It's not clear. it's not clear. There probably is a certain percentage of Polish Jewry which is of Sephardic, of, you know, Spanish Sephardic descent, but it's mamish not clear. In other words, for example, the Shach, and we've heard of the Shach? Yes? Some of us? Okay. The Shach was of Spanish descent. But it's unclear. It's definitely not. I mean, most of the Jews made it to Poland, etc. Poland, Russia, Poland, Ukraine, Belarus, Lithuania. Most of them were from originally from Germany. And again, the clearest, most simple proof to remember and see is they all spoke the same language, which was a form. They called it Deutsch, and we call it today Yiddish. Okay, the Bach. The Bach's name was Rabiel Circus. 1561 to 1640. He was a rabbi in many places. The last place he was in Krakow. What he's best known for is writing his commentary to the Tur, which is called Bayis Chadash. Bayis Chadash, the new house. In other words, Beis Yosef wrote on the Tur something called Joseph's House, Beis Yosef. And the Bach wrote something called Bayis Chadash, the new house. Bach is very interesting, Mechadesh, and again, I'm not going to talk about that much more right now. Very key and critical in terms of halacha. One of the main reasons why is his son-in-law was the Taz. The Taz is Reb David Halevi, 1586 to 1667. One of the key commentators to Shulchan Aruch. Taz was married again. The Taz was married to the Bach's daughter, and I can't resist telling you the famous legend. The Bach's daughter, in other words, Taz's first wife, died young, and the Taz remarried. And at her funeral, the Taz gave a very, very eloquent eulogy. Very eloquent eulogy. After the Shiva, he went to his father-in-law, the Bach, and asked him for his next daughter. And the Bach said, "No way! The wife of your youth dies, and you're so eloquent? You should have been heartbroken. I didn't want to hear eloquence. You're not getting my next daughter." Okay, well, anyone know the term for father-in-law in Yiddish?
Shver.
Okay. So, I don't know. That's a folklore I heard. I don't know if it's true. That's folklore. But the Taz and the Bach, which are around 400 years ago, is the beginning of what I call, you know, I'm not sure if it's accurate, but it's real folklore. Real folklore, which is possibly true. In other words, the folklore about Rashi and the Rambam, it's very difficult to know how much of it's true, and some of it can be so absolutely disproved there's mamish nothing to talk about. But when we're talking about, you know, we're talking about the beginnings of clear historical memory. So the Bach and the Taz are definitely there. Now, in terms of the halacha, the Taz, again, is one of the key commentators on Shulchan Aruch. And just from personal experience, I could tell you, is even when he doesn't explicitly argue with his father-in-law, he usually is arguing with his father-in-law, and which is why I always say that the Taz holds, the Shver is Shver. That's how it is. What can I tell you? Okay. Now let's go on to Tach V'Tat. Anyone know what Tach V'Tat was? The Chamonitsky Massacres. Chamonitsky, 1648-1649. Bogdan Chamonitsky rebels against Poland. Poland at this point has an elected king who was, let's put you this way, not that, you know, motivated. He was not that motivated, and it took some time to get the rebellion under control. In Jewish history, it's considered one of the, you know, great, you know, terrible events of Jewish history, Tach V'Tat. It's contemporary historians are not sure if it was not that it was not bad. But you know, classically you will read that the golden era of Jews in Poland ended in 1648-1649, and there's substantial proof that that's not really true. it definitely could be called the beginning of the end. And it was really a matter of good Polish luck that it didn't happen earlier, because an elective monarch, again, is not the world's, an elective monarch by 20 to 50,000 people is not the world's most brilliant form of you know, determining the executive. And it definitely later on, in other words, real Polish decline in a real method, in a real fashion, really is a little later on, around 1700, a little after 1700, until Russia becomes a real nation, until the rise of Russia and Prussia, which we're going to speak about more next week. It would have just been a blip on the screen. But because it's like relatively close, people like try to put everything together. But historians don't really believe that in terms of decline, of Polish Jewry, economic decline, they feel it was not as significant as people used to think. It definitely, in terms of massacres, a lot of Jews died. That no one's doubting that. The exact numbers, again, are going to be very hard to know, very hard to substantiate. There's no question the Jews of Eastern European descent, anyone's grandmother, great-grandmother, great-grandmother from Eastern Europe? Yeah, no? Yeah, ever spoke to about Chmielnitsky? No? Okay. I'll tell you a story. 20 years ago, I was once like speaking about, I don't know why, I mentioned Chmielnitsky, and there was an Alter Baba there, you know, grandmother from the old generation, and she starts cursing. She starts cursing him, like, really seriously. She was like sort of, I wouldn't call her a real Holocaust survivor, because she saw the writing on the walls and left in 1938, 39. She was really from Hungary. But she left in 1938. She could see something was happening. She left. She moved to England. So, but okay, Hitler, I wouldn't speak about. But Chmielnitsky, I figured that's a long time ago. She's not going to get that upset about it. She starts cursing Chmielnitsky in a really serious fashion. I turn to her and say to her, Mrs. Weiss, how long ago do you think Chmielnitsky lived? She says, about 100 years ago. As I said, no, closer to 350 years ago. And she didn't really believe me. But this is in terms of Jewish history, it was, you know, deeply given over, and everyone knew about it. Okay, I just want to get in one more thing. I know it's drop late, but we gotta like do as much as we can. So I want to go through the secondary effects of Kabbalah. Secondary effects of Kabbalah are, I mean, there was, again, even though there was debate about how many people should learn it, a lot of people were learning it. And that gets us on to Shabtai Tzvi. Shabtai Tzvi is a classic example of misuse of Kabbalah. I hope to speak about it this year in my regular class, but I'm not sure I'm going to be able to. The bare facts are is he apostated to Islam in 1666. And the effects of Shabtai Tzvi can be compared to nuclear explosion. And what Polish Jewry went through for the rest of its history is the fallout, the nuclear fallout of everything that happened with Shabtai Tzvi. Rabbi Yitzhak Kuttner, anyone here, we know who Rabbi Yitzhak Kuttner was? Yeah, Rosh Yeshiva Chaim Berlin. He felt that the Shabtai Tzvi, you know, ended the era of deep, widespread Amunah and Bias Mashiach and coming Mashiach, and it was really never the same afterwards. There was a fringe element that followed Shabtai Tzvi for at least 100 years, and again, I'm not going to get to that this year in a history class. Maybe, assuming I do it next year, I'll get to it. The basic reaction by the Rabbanim was they forbade mass learning of Kabbalah. Of course, there was a technical problem with that, is we're well after the printing press, and many of the Sifrei Kabbalah have been printed. And when the books are out there, when the information is out there, then people will try to use it, even if they shouldn't. And they also put charamim, excommunications, on anyone who, you know, deviates from normative Judaism. And again, the Vat Abra Rutz is height of its power. So it's able to like enforce it relatively well. But there were serious problems amongst Polish Jewry which were existing from a pastation from post Shabbat Tzvi until afterwards, and we'll get into more of that next week. Fine.